Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
We also explain words and language rules, all while bringing you stories and information from around the world. Today on the program, you will hear stories from Anna Mateo, Brian Lynn, Mario Ritter, Alice Bryant, and Jill Robbins. Later, Katie Weaver will bring us this week's education report. But first, here is Anna Mateo.
U.S. President Donald Trump has removed Acting Attorney General Sally Yates for refusing to enforce or defend an executive order he signed last week limiting immigration. The president appointed Dana Bente to replace Yates as the acting head of the Justice Department. Bente immediately canceled Yates's order and vowed to defend the lawful orders of our president. The order stops all refugees from entering the United States for 120 days and bans Syrian refugees indefinitely. It also blocks people from Iraq, Iran, Libya, Syria, Sudan, Yemen, and Somalia. The Associated Press noted that Yates's removal was a warning to other administration officials that Trump is prepared to terminate those who refuse to carry out his orders. The news agency called the firing an extraordinary public showdown. Yates was named to the second highest position in the Justice Department by then-President Barack Obama. On Monday, she ordered the department's lawyers not to defend the immigration order. In a memo, she wrote, "At present, I am not convinced that the defense of the executive order is consistent with these responsibilities, nor am I convinced that the executive order is lawful." The career prosecutor added, "For as long as I am the acting attorney general, the Department of Justice will not present arguments in defense of the executive order, unless and until I become convinced that it is appropriate to do so." A few hours later, Yates was fired. The White House press secretary released a statement saying, "Yates betrayed the Department of Justice by refusing to enforce a legal order designed to protect the citizens of the United States." It said the department's Office of Legal Counsel approved the order. Many Democrats criticized the decision to fire Yates. Steny Hoyer, a senior Democratic congressman, called the decision alarming. He said the American people need to consider whether President Trump simply plans to dismiss anyone with whom he disagrees. "And I hope my Republican colleagues stand up and express concern over this as well." Chuck Schumer is the Senate Minority Leader. He wrote on Twitter that the Attorney General should pledge fidelity to the law and the Constitution, not the White House. "The fact that this administration doesn't understand that is chilling." But Republican Senator Ted Cruz strongly defended the decision to fire Yates. He said Yates's refusal to support the executive order is a fitting and sad last act of Obama's Department of Justice. President Trump was exactly right to fire an acting attorney general who refused to carry out her constitutional duty to enforce and defend the law, Cruz said. This week, the Senate Judiciary Committee is expected to approve the nomination of Senator Jeff Sessions for Attorney General. He is expected to defend and enforce Trump's immigration order. Senator Sessions was a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee in 2015, when Yates was confirmed to be the Deputy Attorney General. During a hearing on her confirmation, Sessions asked Yates, "If the views the president wants to execute are unlawful, should the Attorney General or the Deputy Attorney General say no?" Yates said she believed that the Attorney General or the Deputy Attorney General has an obligation to follow the law and the Constitution, and to give their independent legal advice to the president. I'm Ana Mateo.
More and more cities across the world are experimenting with driverless vehicles on public streets. Two of the latest to conduct testing are Paris, France, and Las Vegas, Nevada. The cities have used self-driving electric buses to carry passengers on short rides to try out the technology and see how humans react to it. In Paris, two buses have been transporting passengers across a bridge between two of the city's busiest rail stations. The vehicles, built by French company EasyMile, travel in a special safety lane created for the project. The fully electric buses can carry up to 10 people. The testing in Paris is expected to last 3 months. If things go well, officials plan to launch more driverless bus lines later this year. Jean-Louis Masica is the deputy mayor of Paris. He told reporters at a recent launch event that autonomous vehicles represent a revolution happening in many cities around the world. He said self-driving technology is set to change our urban environment and public space in a spectacular fashion over the next 20 years. Transportation officials say they are planning to use the bus to connect neighborhoods to rail stations around Paris. They will also help ease traffic crowding and reduce severe pollution in the city. In Las Vegas, the city recently launched the first driverless shuttle bus in the United States. The 12-passenger bus from French company Navya has no steering wheel or brake pedals. It uses cameras and sensors to avoid other vehicles and people while making its way down city streets. The electric vehicles can reach a top speed of 40 kilometers per hour. The bus operated for a 2-week period along one of the busiest entertainment areas in Las Vegas. Rides during the shuttle experiment were free. The ride was smooth. It's clean and quiet and seats comfortably, said Las Vegas Mayor Carolyn Goodman after taking a ride. Several autonomous shuttle buses are expected to be deployed in Las Vegas later this year to transport passengers through main areas of the city. The estimated cost of the program is about $10,000 per month. Officials say while this might seem high, the driverless shuttles could still save the city money. The current yearly cost for a single bus and driver is about $1 million. I'm Brian Lynn.
An increasing number of countries are banning North Korea's state-owned airline because of United Nations Security Council restrictions. Last January, North Korea carried out its fourth nuclear test. In response, the UN Security Council approved a resolution placing strong economic restrictions, or sanctions, on the North. Among those restrictions is the use of airplanes to move banned items for supply, sale, transfer, or export. Resolution 2270 calls for all member states to deny permission to any North Korean aircraft to take off from, land at, or overfly unless under the condition of landing for inspection. The Security Council recently reported that Malaysia has banned Air Koryo from taking off from or landing in any airport it controls. Malaysian officials at the UN confirmed the report. It said Air Koryo airplanes also will not be permitted to fly over the country. Air Koryo began flying from the North Korean capital Pyongyang to Kuala Lumpur once a week in 2011. The UN report says the airline made its last flight to the Malaysian capital on June 8, 2014. Since the UN Security Council approved Resolution 2270, more countries have been banning North Korean passenger jets. In October, the air transport director at the Kuwait International Airport sent VOA an email about the issue. It said that the Kuwaiti government had banned Air Koryo from landing in the country's airport. The airline had been flying to Kuwait City from Pyongyang since 2011. Air Koryo airplanes often stopped for refueling in Pakistan when they were flying between Pyongyang and Kuwait. But in July, Pakistani officials told VOA that they had decided to ban North Korean flights from the Benazir Bhutto Islamabad International Airport because of the Security Council's sanctions. An Air Koryo flight last stopped at the airport on June 28, 2016. In April, Air Koryo stopped flying to Bangkok, Thailand, shortly after the Thai government said it supported the Security Council sanctions. The government suggested that it was considering taking action against the airline. I'm Mario Ritter.
Medical marijuana is legal in parts of the United States and several countries in South America. Argentina is not one of them. But that has not stopped a group of Argentine mothers from growing cannabis illegally at home. They want to help their children who suffer from diseases such as epilepsy and autism. Valeria Soleche's son, Emiliano, has epilepsy. Traditional drugs stopped the epileptic seizures, but left him unable to smile or socialize. Soleche decided to give her 10-year-old son some cannabis oil in December 2015. All the mothers remember that first day when we gave the oil to our children, she told VOA. She said that within a few hours, her son went from looking at nothing and having no reaction to looking at her and smiling. Soleche said she had waited for that moment for 10 years. And you just cannot believe it, she said. She is now president of a group called Mama Cultiva Argentina, or Mom Cultivates. The group shares knowledge of growing cannabis and pushes for the legalization of medical marijuana. She is so confident about its effectiveness that she describes her group as a public health network. We did what the state cannot do for us, that is to cultivate a lot of cannabis to have enough for all of us all the time, she said. But there is limited scientific research so far on the medical benefits of cannabis oil. There is also concern about potential psychedelic effects that marijuana may have on children. Carlos Magdalena is a neurologist for children. He said, as a natural therapy, a small amount of cannabis oil does not have bad side effects. And Magdalena added, the side effects are less severe than those of legal prescription drugs. Countries like Uruguay and Chile have already legalized the use of medical marijuana. As the Argentine government is studying its use, Valeria Soleche hopes her country will follow next year. Soleche said the government would find out everything that she already knows and that she will continue to grow cannabis for her son. I'm Alice Bryant.
finding quality, low-cost housing can be a problem for university students, especially in the Netherlands. Last year, the average cost to rent a house in Amsterdam rose to over 2,000 euros a month. Now, students have another choice. They can live with refugees. The Startblok project is a group of city-owned apartment homes that opened in July 2016. The project has 463 studio apartments and 102 rooms. Half of them are for Dutch students and recent university graduates. The other half are for refugees who have official permits to live there. In exchange for low-cost housing, the students and refugees are expected to take care of the property together. The goal is to mix the two sides together so they learn more about each other's culture. Everyone in Startblok is between the ages of 18 and 27. The Dutch are mostly students or those who recently finished their studies. Of the refugees, two-thirds come from Syria and Eritrea. City officials hope that as the young people share the responsibility of operating the apartments, the refugees will become a part of the local community sooner. Nahom Berhan is a 24-year-old Eritrean refugee. He arrived in Europe after crossing the Mediterranean Sea by boat. He says he is happy the local government found a place for him in Startblok.
The life here is more of observing from a lot of people around me. So when I see them, I can learn a lot of things from them. And whenever I have problems with translation, homeworks, or anything, everyone is open to help you anytime.
A graduate student in architecture, Abdellah Tsegert, fled the war in Syria. He enjoys living with other students much more than living in a refugee shelter.
We got something so important, it's the friendship. We have a lot of friends in here, and maybe if we are out of Starbucks, we will not get this friends.
Tekwisha Begheer is a Dutch university student. She moved to the project because she could not find low-cost housing in Amsterdam. She says she had never met a refugee before living here.
In the beginning, I had my thoughts about it. Because of the culture difference. But from the beginning I was living here, it was all gone.
Other European cities are interested in the Startblok model. Fleur Eyman is a graduate student who also takes care of public relations for the project. She is surprised by how much good attention they are receiving.
So there's, for example, the municipality of Antwerp, Berlin, Athens, Vienna. They all came over here and showed interest.
The Netherlands has accepted large numbers of refugees. Other programs in Amsterdam have given refugees space for a short period in old prisons. I'm Jill Robbins.
Almost 30,000 students attend classes in the Chula Vista Elementary School District in California. The elementary school district is the largest in the state. It operates 45 schools between the city of San Diego and the United States border with Mexico. The majority of students are between 5 and 12 years old. The district is also one of California's most diverse. 68% of students are Hispanic, and 35% are learning English. Some of the students come from the Mexican city of Tijuana and speak Spanish at home. The English language ability among these students differs widely. The Salt Creek Elementary School works with students in the town of Chula Vista, about 15 kilometers north of the Mexican border. The boys and girls there share their cultural traditions and learn from one another, including the languages spoken by other students. Francisco Escobedo heads the Chula Vista Elementary School District.
We see Spanish as an asset, not a liability. So we use that richness that they come with and build upon it.
The public discussion of immigration issues during and after the 2016 elections led California to take action. Escobedo wrote to the parents across the school district. He told them that their elementary schools were safe areas for students of all citizenship situations. He said the letter helped ease worries. I received an email from a teacher thanking me for that letter that helped her talk to her child and ease his fear, because he came to school crying, Escobedo said. He came to school in fear that someone will come and remove him from the classroom. In Chula Vista, the classroom is more than a safe place, however. It is where boys and girls can celebrate bilingualism and the sharing of cultures. Emma Sanchez heads the Language Development and Instruction Services and Support Office at Chula Vista Elementary Schools.
Our students come and go from both countries, so we want to empower and build our teachers' capacity to support the children in both languages.
Sixth grader Valeria came to the United States from Tijuana. She describes her life as ideal in her ability to speak two languages and to travel in and out of Mexico.
It's mainly just going back and forth, visiting my dad and coming back to my mom, then going to school.
Others, like fourth grader Lucia, say bilingualism is important so they can communicate with students and extended family.
I feel happy because I'm with my grandparents and really happy that I see them, because sometimes time flies, so I should better stay with my grandparents until they're gone.
Lucia hopes her language skills will help her get a good job and meet people from many more cultures around the world. I'm Katie Weaver.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.